Would you give your mum, dad, aunt or that uncle who hugged your partner a little too long free access to your phone?
Oh, no!
Oh, my God, it's a really long video. Ew!
In Dave's brand new YouTube original, Get Off My Phone, we've got six comedians to give their phones over to a relative with total freedom to read messages, DMs, photos and browser history.
Where's your search history?
Sorry?
What to do, tips for relief.
The rules are simple. Their relative can read anything they want and even make calls from the comedian's phone.
What is this?
What is... I don't want this one.
That looks really bad.
Starring Tanya Moore, Anya Magliano, Finlay Christie, Travis J with his mum Angie Lamar, Hayley Morris, Grace Campbell and dad Alistair Campbell.
Slightly sexually compromising
people. Divulging their deepest digital secrets.
What the hell is happening?
Get Off My Phone, a Dave YouTube original. Available now on Dave's YouTube channel.
Hello there, podders. Ben Shires here again, wishing you a warm and sticky welcome to the Dave Weekly during this warm and sticky time of year. It's close, isn't it? I hate it when it's this muggy, but then I suppose Brixton, where I live, is always a bit muggy. I was already down a wallet and a phone by the time I got on the tube today. Luckily, we've managed to swap the streets of the capital lined with people trying to take your cash for the streets of Edinburgh lined with people trying to take your cash. But at least this time, it's in exchange for tickets to see a show. Sure, I mean, many of these would be considered crimes against the art of performance, but then not all art is meant to be enjoyed anyway, is it? Otherwise, who can explain the existence of Justin Bieber? Anyway, joining us for our second Edinburgh Fest special are two funny fellas who seemingly don't know the meaning of the word boring, despite their extensive vocabularies. First up, it's fuzzy head funny man Rory McGrath, who educates us on a range of intellectual subject matter before Brett Goldstein, star of Ricky Gervais's Derek and purveyor of highbrow smut, charms us with tales of internet erotica. It's just another day at the Dave Weekly.
Excellent. Rory McGrath, welcome to the Dave Weekly.
Thank you. Very, very excited to be here.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have you. We were just chatting off air about a myriad of subjects.
I was in a very early bullshit form, wasn't
I? Yeah, you were.
Talking about, actually, literally bullshit. We were talking about leather and why it smells of horse excrement. Yeah. Because it used to be treated in horse excrement, of course.
In the great battle of the farmyard animals, I think the horses would feel that they've got one up on the cows over that.
Yeah, I think, and piss, of course, let's not forget piss. I mean, piss has been taken for many purposes over the years. No, it's true. I mean, for example, when they're making material to be dyed, they used to soak it in a mixture of piss and seaweed.
Mm.
You know, and in fact, London piss was considered the richest and was sent up to Yorkshire, where they soaked all this material in.
Well, here's a fact. I believe that I may have spoken about
it. It's a strange way to get into this, isn't it? Sorry, we've come in rather
you
steeply.
You say that, Rory, but I think we're talking about something that unites everyone, and it's those kind of subjects which I think people can relate to, which are a great introduction to any podcast discussion.
Yeah.
But yeah, I once got a chance to go down some sewers, and I was speaking to the chap who was guiding me around, and he said that the different parts of the sewer smelt differently based on the affluence of the residents that created said materials.
And did he get to recognise? Would he know that, oh, this is the Italian restaurant, or this is the...
This has got a rich, nutty aroma. It's been aged.
Yes.
I don't know, but I just kind of thought it provides actual empirical
evidence. I should ask you, why were you going around the sewers as a matter of interest?
Is just one of my many hobbies. Just a gutter snipe.
Yeah. And, literally.
Yeah. No, it was for a show that never made it to the light of day, ironically enough. But
What about rats? Is it true that rats in sewers? I mean, everyone says that, you know, in any big city you're only 5 feet from a rat. I've never ever seen a rat.
I've seen loads of mice. In fact, I'm known as something of a mouse exterminator around my parts. Not that I advocate killing of any animals, but...
No, unless you're going to eat them.
Yeah, exactly. But luckily, they're great on toast, so
mice, yeah. They're a Roman delicacy, mice.
Yeah, they
used to dip dormice in honey and coat them in sesame seeds.
Mm.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have them any other way.
Me too,
People call me bourgeois, but I think that's the way...
I like the savoury ones, you know, where you dip in guacamole.
Are they the white mice that used to get down the newsagents?
No, they're the vanilla ones.
Whatever happened to them? What happened to penny sweets?
What happened to shit... confectionery.
What happened to sugar?
That's a lovely segue, wasn't it? Well, you see, you're young, but I remember. You don't remember Five Boys, do you?
No.
Caramello.
No, these all sound like made-up Roald Dahl sweets.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, so anyway, here's to going back to the collection of shit. Bateman, the name Bateman, it comes from the name of the person. You know how you have baker used to be baker, butcher used to be butcher, you know. Well, Bateman was the guy who went around from house to house collecting piss and shit to be sold to the leather tanning industry. So if, I would say, if you know someone, especially if it's a teacher called Bateman, you can remind him what his name means.
Yeah. Shit collector. And I'm sure that won't land you in any trouble because you're literally just replicating facts for them.
Exactly. This is strange because, you know, people accuse me of lowering the tone of places and interviews, and now we haven't really got that high, have we? We went straight in at the bottom.
I think, yeah, if you set the bar low, then you can't really lower it much further. Yeah. So there's no tone, there's just tone maintenance.
I'm struggling now to think of how we can get up. You know, can we talk about Tchaikovsky symphonies or something?
Oh, we could do, but I'm sure we'll come back to the fact that he was somehow influenced by scatological desire. So let's...
Actually, I think he was, wasn't he? He was a rampant homosexual.
Yeah, one of his big things.
So we're straight back down there again. Even Tchaikovsky could dig us out.
How about we try and move on to something, you know, which has been a bastion of society for many years, and something which your Edinburgh show is kind of premised around, and that is music and wine and song, alcohol and song particularly.
That's good. I thought you were doing a segue. And talking of shit, let's talk about your Edinburgh show.
It was on the tip of my tongue, and I thought, let's be professional about this. No, but it's you know, these are other unifying factors, aren't they? Things that have been around for decades, like the Roman dormice.
Yeah, my hobby is writing songs, and I always wanted to. To do them in public, you see. Now, the songs I write, like all sort of blokes, they're sort of tortured songs about broken relationships and, you know, relationships haven't started and desires of, you know, desires for people that you're not allowed to have. But I the only way I could sort of get out there and sing was to start off doing comedy songs, you know, so because people know me through comedy. And I thought, well, if I wrote enough sort of comedy songs, then I might be able to sort of slip the odd serious song in and sort of slowly segue. But these songs are mainly, there's about 20 songs, mostly new songs. And they're all funny, I hope, you know, I hope.
So this is your eventual move towards being taken as seriously as someone like Kate Bush or Barry.
Kate Bush.
Yeah.
Now you're talking about Bush now. You see, straight. You just can't just leave it alone, can you?
Do you know, my psychologist,
of all the people you could have chosen. Yeah.
this is therapy now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
You used to talking about my mother. Oops.
Yeah, did you like her breasts, your mother? Actually, I like your mother's breasts, to be honest.
Well, they're very shapely. She's a fine figure of a woman. But I mean, these songs then, is it... Well, because I always wonder about the genesis of writing a comedy song. Do you start with the basis of the musical structure? Do you start with a funny idea? Do you think I'm going to spoof this style of music or this particular song? I mean, what is the one that works for you?
That is the longest question I've ever been asked.
Should we rewind? Yeah, yeah. How do you write a comedy song?
No, that's very good, because you covered all of them. Yes, you sometimes start with a structure or a musical, a bit of phrase of music, or you sometimes start with a one-liner. You sometimes think of a genre or a specific song you'd like to parody, or something that you can actually play with one's limited ability on the guitar. So, yeah, all those things that you mentioned in that very long question.
Should we question. Do all the questions like that? I'll just provide a load of possible answers.
Yeah, I'll say yes, no, yes, maybe.
It's going to be the most gripping interview. But I mean, when you've got a song that you've written, do you ever get that feeling that, oh, this could be a goodie? This is one that's
I like it. The guy I'm working with, Philip Pope is a very, very good musician. He sings, he's got a perfect pitch, so he can sing harmonies. He plays the piano brilliantly, guitar brilliantly. He arranges music. He's a great ear for voices as well, and he's a good actor. And so we hope it's musical. I mean, a lot of people have seen the show and said, oh, well, those songs are really nice. Why did you spoil it by putting all those sort of crude jokes in? That's it. And so I thought, if we could sort of segue from that just to removing the jokes and just doing them as songs. I'm getting near the age when I'm in sight of being an aging Rocky. You see, what, Jagger's 70, is he now? So it's on the horizon there, you know. When I'm old enough, I'll be an aging rocker.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to see the Stones at Hyde Park recently, and Jagger was doing his... Well, the moves like only Jagger can, obviously, strutting his stuff. He's still got it. I don't know how
I saw him at the Isle of Wight a few years ago, and it was a bit... I thought it was a bit embarrassing. This very, very old, skinny bloke in a skin-tight leather suit, you know, comes on and starts jiggling around. I found it a bit laughable.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure there's a lot to jiggle, if I'm honest, Rory. It's a lot of sinew.
But
it's quite interesting. I think the likes of him and Iggy Pop are of that generation where they're actually just being preserved by sort of formaldehyde or something that they accidentally injected.
They do look like
that.
I'm probably sort of 15 years and 3 stone away from that sort of aging rock image. But you know, I've got time.
What a dream to aspire to, though.
Yeah, well, hey, Isle of Wight in 2020, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Watch out, Isle of Wight. Yeah. You mentioned Phil Pope earlier. You and he are part of this a collective called the Short and Curlies.
We started off many years ago doing a country western band, which is called The Death of Country, or Death by Country. And the idea was we did all the songs with it was sort of country style. And then when we tried to sort of lose the country image because it was just too limiting, we changed the name to Short and Curlies because he's short and I've got curly hair. You see how it works? And it's a sort of a cheeky reference to, let's face it, Bush, Kate Bush.
We're back again. Hello.
Hello, Kate. We're back.
Anyone for Bush, please a like now. I thought it was quite interesting, though, because the short and curly analogy also works for a kind of direct transposition onto Simon and Garfunkel, which is
related, I love that,
to your show title
that
this year,
so
Bridge
good.
Over Troubled
That's so
Lager.
Good. You've done some work on this interview, haven't you? Yeah, that's very good. Well,
yeah,
have.
The 5 minutes prior to you arriving were very
good.
Fruitful.
The short and curly, so people who see us now and say, why didn't you call it Bald and Fatty instead of short and curly? So I won't tell you which is which. But short and curly, yeah, Simon and Garfunkel. Because Paul Simon is famously short, which makes everybody think that Art Garfunkel is very tall. But Art Garfunkel is very short.
Oh, is he?
If you saw Art Garfunkel on his own, you'd say, what a short man. And then when Paul Simon comes, you think, oh, sorry, my mistake.
It's true. You're positively Lilliputian.
Yeah, that's why Paul Simon likes having Art Garfunkel with him.
Yeah, and that's probably why he wears diamonds on the side of his
shoes. I
heard
a story that Paul Simon would only meet people below a certain height.
Oh, really?
Because my very good friend Douglas Adams, rest his soul, who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide, whom I knew very well, was mad about Simon Garfunkel. He was also a very good guitarist, Douglas Adams. And he was lucky enough, because of who he was, he got a backstage pass after a Simon Garfunkel concert. And Paul Simon's management came out and looked at everybody with that sort of measuring, that sort of undertaker's look, you measure them, and said, he can't come in to Douglas.
No way.
Because Parley can't see people who are over 5'7".
Well, he literally can't see them.
Oh, that makes sense.
He's going to see your chin and not much else.
His neck, really.
That's ridiculous. Couldn't they just build like a trench backstage?
That is a story I've heard. I'm passing on a story I heard, by the way, just in case Paulie's listening. And I got very sensitive now because you call your show Bridge Over Troubled Lager and you think he's famously litigious. Litigious. What's that word?
Yeah, litigious.
That word. He's famously. And I'm making jokes. We're looking forward to extra publicity when Simon and Garfunkel's lawyers get to hear about this. And I thought, why am I saying that?
And then you're just starting a very minor but pursuing a campaign against him and his height as well. His heightism.
I know. That's the sort of butterfly's wing, isn't it, on this side of the ocean?
Yeah, exactly.
Which a shit storm of legal action.
Yeah, before you know it, there's going to be another war manned by short Americans. It's that kind of Tom Cruise syndrome, though, isn't it? It's that, I think, when you're of a certain kind of dominance in your field, and there's something that you can't influence, i.e. your height.
But he's shorter than Paul Simon, isn't he, Tom Cruise? Tom Cruise is only 4.5 inches.
Yeah, I mean, they used to say things like, obviously, that he used to walk on slope above people. And
I've
stuff
seen
like
him on
that.
Television. He is, on my television, he's 4.5 inches.
Yeah.
I don't mean on the screen, I mean walking along the top of it.
Yeah, he arrives in a matchbox and his agent just unloads him. Like that. It's easy
says,
to
don't
travel.
Mention his height. Don't mention his height. Tom's very sensitive about his height.
Yeah.
Where is it? Oh.
Do you know, it's really weird that I think when people have a thing and they're known for that thing, it's so difficult to not want to just resort to that straight away.
He is known for his thing.
that
thing. Because his thing is 4.5 inches as well.
Which makes it very awkward, I imagine, buying clothes.
Toulouse-Lautrec was like that, you know. Toulouse-Lautrec, the famous painter, who used to paint ballet dancers and things. He was famously short, but had a famously huge member.
Is that true?
And he used to do an act, which was... I won't tell you what the act was.
But you can't say that now.
The French called it... He called it the act La Tétière, which means the teapot.
Right.
So you have to work out what his act was.
Wow.
Yeah. In fact, there's probably someone doing a similar thing at Edinburgh, because every Edinburgh Fringe, all shows are covered, aren't they? Let's face it.
Yeah, there's, that's true.
So, a French dwarf with no clothes on pretending to be a teapot. I mean,
a huge gamut of interests.
Yeah.
Well, there'll be more from Rory in a bit, but if his humour proved a bit puerile for your tastes, luckily, here's Brett Goldstein to bring things back up a notch, discussing, amongst other things, his new show, Brett Goldstein Contains Scenes of an Adult Nature.
Okay, we're joined on the Dave Weekly by the lovely Brett Goldstein. Hello, Brett.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, how are you?
All right, thanks.
Excellent, thank you for coming and joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're in our lovely sort of palatial apartment in Edinburgh still.
It's seriously nice.
I mean, compared to your digs for the festival,
don't even start me.
What are we talking about here?
This room is bigger than the entire flat that four of us are living in.
Okay. And is there, because there's no partitioning walls in this room as well. Hopefully you've got
something of that sort. We have got partitioning walls, yeah. But you can hear everyone. I want no one to get laid in our flat. I realised this morning because I can hear everything.
I mean, you really shouldn't be pressing your ear against with the tumbler. Part of the problem, surely.
I shouldn't be holding a horn to my ear, but, you know, still, when I say I want no one to get laid, I want everyone to get laid.
Just not
because
in
I can
the vicinity.
Hear everything. Yeah.
I remember seeing you once, and you kind of started, you teed yourself up by saying you're more of a storyteller than a joke teller,
right?
Which I thought was...
Did I say that?
Yeah, which I thought was quite a revelation for a comedian to sort of...
Did I say that on stage?
Yeah.
Did
yeah.
I? Which well, I regret that.
I thought it was a great way to
endure
the
audience.
It's
supposed to be ephemeral. Why are you remembering this shit?
Yeah, sorry to bring that up. But then you went on and told some brilliant stories, and I think...
Right.
You kind of referenced the time which you ended up putting into a whole comedy show, one of your Edinburgh Hours, which was the
strip club,
growing up in a strip club.
Yeah.
And I thought it was brilliant. And I guess when you've got such great life experience like that, do you kind of think almost trying to sit down and write a joke for a joke's sake becomes, it feels quite a trite and contrived thing to do?
No, I think everyone has to do whatever they do. I like the personal stuff. Like that's what. But then I like all sorts of things. But I think the thing that I'm interested in doing is the. I like it when you see someone on stage and you think, "Fuck, they're really sharing something true."
Yeah.
But I equally like. I love Tim Vine. He's not sharing anything, but I love him. And you know, anyone could do whatever. But I certainly try with the new show, there's still all the sort of personal stuff, but I think the joke rate is a lot higher.
Yeah.
Still have jokes in it. Otherwise you are just telling
it's just a lecture then.
Otherwise
isn't it?
It's a spoken word lecture, isn't it? And then I went here. All right, mate.
So I mean, let's talk about the new show. Brett Goldstein Contains Scenes of an Adult Nature.
Yes.
I mean, you must be prepared for the fact that again, you're skirting around sort of smut in a way.
Yeah.
Is this?
This one's ruder.
Yeah.
As well. I'm stepping up.
Are you trying to corner the market in? Have you just got? Is your audience just one big back row of men?
Of men in chairs
on their own with Kleenex? Is that?
I genuinely had. I forgot that when I did the strip club show, a man came in a trench coat on his own and sat in the front, and I had a joke that I used to open with where I'd say something like. Because it's usually sort of middle class older people in Edinburgh, and my opening joke was always like, "Oh, how lovely of you to come." I was expecting just one man in a trench coat on his own sat at the front, and here you are, sir. And I'd say that to someone who wasn't there, and then that night I said it, and it was, and I looked straight at him, and then I went, "Oh, sorry, oh shit!" Like, and people must have thought, "God, this guy's good at improv." He just
he is just off the top of his head.
Top of his head, he's done that.
Where's he get this from?
Yeah,
maybe it's someone who's like trolling your show. He's seen it the night before. Though I'm going to screw him up.
Yeah, I felt sorry for him. Anyway, what was the question? Unfortunately, or fortunately, I mean, it is what my life. it's what this. The strip club story happened 10 years ago, and the story that happens in this show happened 10 years ago as well. So it's like I'm always 10 years behind. You know what I mean? I'm catching every year. I don't know if I'll continue in this vein, but if I do, the next year's show would be about 10 years ago.
Yeah, remind me to come see you in 10 years.
Yeah,
discussing we'll talk this about this. At length.
And the one thing I regret... Brett Carson did a Dave TV podcast. That'll be the show. But... And... it isn't sort of a deliberate thing. Or maybe it is. It's like this show is about, well, the big sort of theme of it is sort of internet pornography.
Mm.
And I suppose going from strip clubs to pornography, it's a legitimate...
I mean...
it is actually a continuation of some of the...
Yeah, it's not a difficult leap to make, really, is it?
And the third one will be about prostitution, and then I'll wrap it up and do a show about flowers.
Brilliant. I think we've all been waiting
you've
for
all
that
learned it.
Horticultural bent from yeah. Brett Goldstein. I mean, it's quite interesting as well, because it's topical at the moment.
Very
it's
topical.
Pornography.
I'll keep
David
to
Cameron
it.
Launching his crusade.
Yeah.
I mean, is that something that you kind of see as a blessing, or is that something that you then got to think, oh, God, I've got to yeah. write more stuff in comment on that?
Well, actually, I just spent the last 2 days, I had to change it a little bit because I have to reference that Cameron stuff. I mean, it's really, the thing is, it seems like every day, oh my God, this is more topical, more topical, more topical. But it has been. It has been for a few years.
Mm.
And it's only now, I think it's because the government keeps talking about it now that it becomes a bigger thing. But I don't know that they know what they're, it's so complicated.
Mm. Well, I mean, what's your view? If you were to say, is pornography, very broad brushstrokes here,
yeah.
but is it good or is it bad? What would be your opinion?
I mean, I talk about it a lot in the show. I think I'm quite on the bad side of it
mm.
because it's not that I'm anti-porn, but I think there's problems with the internet porn.
Right.
Because of how fast it, because of how endless and fast it is.
Do you watch it on super speed?
Yeah.
You can slow that right down.
I mean, listen.
Just go for the detail.
You could just whiz through the lot of it.
Yeah.
And I've tried to.
It's not like it was when it was on dial-up, is it?
No.
It's
in the good old days.
Changed.
You leisurely stroll
through
porn.
You have to premeditate that
now
kind of stuff.
Now it's a sprint.
Yeah, really. I used to stay up for Tarrant on TV. You know,
just to see a boob.
Like, either
yeah.
side of the advert, he'd have the funny foreign commercial where the woman, like, her
yeah.
bra would twang off. And I'd be like, oh, my God, this
yeah.
is TV?
You pause.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But so I think in a way, it's like one solution, I think, is you should have more sex in other things, more representations of sex. Because I'm not anti-sex, obviously. But if all that everyone's seeing is kind of abusive sex and we've pushed it all to the internet, like, oh, don't look, we can look over here where we're on our own, that's bad. But if you go, no, have sex on telly, have sex in cinema, have sex in book, have sex everywhere, but proper... This is how people have sex, so that
proper
you're
normal
seeing,
consensual sex.
Yeah,
that's
you're
fine.
Seeing more representations of, oh, okay, that's cool.
So your take home message from
my
this
message
is
let's have
let's
more
fight
sex
with sex.
Yeah, let's put more of it out there. You know, and women who look like this, and men who look like this, and this is, you know, and here's two people enjoying themselves.
Yeah,
weirdly.
I think, you know, as much as we could probably talk on this for a lot longer, okay. there is something else that I want to ask you
go
about
on.
Because what a lot of people will recognise you from is Derek,
yeah.
the Ricky Gervais
thanks.
Show, which
well,
you were brilliant in. I think everyone was brilliant in. Great ensemble cast.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, you know, what was it like to be involved in something that was that you kind of know, because I guess when they started filming The Office, nobody knew
yeah.
it was going to be this huge thing. But
yeah.
when you're working with Gervais, Carl Pilkington, David Earle,
yeah.
those kind of caliber of people, you kind of have an inkling it's going to be all right, don't you?
Yeah. Well, it was the, I mean, it's hard to talk about without sounding like a dick, but like people say this, but it's genuinely like a dream come true. It's like, these are all my heroes. And to have, I mean, fuck, when I got the call, I got a call saying, are you free tomorrow to go and meet Ricky Gervais in his office? I was like, I could cancel that. Yeah, but, you know, it was amazing. And the actual job was brilliant. I mean, my only sort of downside is he works so fast that it's all quite short.
Ricky was playing Derek, the
yes.
titular character, who is very much of a singular kind of, I don't know how you describe it. He's very kind of, he's an interesting layered character.
Yeah.
He's, I don't know on what spectrum he's on, but he's, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it weird watching him go from that to then being quite directorial and quite sort of, you know, telling people what to do, like switching from one to the other?
He's brilliant. He's really brilliant at it. It just happens. You know the scene where he's crying in the pilot? He just did that. He literally just sat down and did it. There was no... It was amazing. Like, everyone was just like, fuck me. He's brilliant. He just turns it on and off.
The other thing I wanted to bring up was that you and David Earle are on that show. Two of arguably the best looking men in comedy. Now, the thing is, for people...
I say that about him, but he does not say that about me.
Oh, really? Yeah. People don't know this about David Earle because he plays Brian Gittins and other cretinous characters who don't necessarily
incredibly
look...
Incredibly good looking
men. Is it, and Brett, you're being very, very bashful here, but you are you often cited as a handsome man.
Where?
In comedy circles.
Where is this ever happened?
My circles. no, I mean,
is this you?
Yeah, just me. My girlfriend doesn't like it, but she gets a bit jealous. No, I think it's. Did that ever present? Was there a lot of sort of preening on set between
me and David L? Yeah. No, because me and David L are the most insecure, pathetic, self-loathing people you've ever met.
Whereas Ricky Gervais constantly checking
Ricky
in the
Gervais
mirror.
Mirror topless all day. No way.
And I guess just to wrap up, Brett, where can people see your show all about these pornographic
disgusting
musings?
It's at 9:30 at the Pleasance Courtyard in the Beneath.
All right, well, thanks a lot for dropping by, Brett.
Thanks very much.
Cheers.
A lot of fun. Thanks.
Here's some more from Mr. McGrath. The first comedy song I ever heard was by a chap called Ivor Biggin. Do you remember him?
Ivor Biggin.
He did the song I'm a Wanker in the 70s, and it reached a very respectable, I think, number 22 in the charts, based on the fact that it received no airplay, and Johnny Rotten said it as his single of the week in the NME.
Ah, fantastic.
Which was, that was
I
the
remember
refrain.
Ivor Biggin.
I'm a... but yeah, I thought the I'm a Wanker song brilliant in that it's now used, I don't know if you know this, now used in certain clubs as the clear-out song at the end of the night. You know, they
really?
Play a song. Like there's also that disco version of Nelly the Elephant I've heard lots of. But they play the Ivor Biggin classic, I'm a Wanker, comes on at the end of the night in order to disperse any lingering crowds.
That's fascinating. I've actually cleared a place late night singing Gordon Lightfoot's If You Could Read My Mind as karaoke.
Really? And your place... show is musically based.
Yeah. The place was heaving, but I was with a friend of mine who says, oh, go and sing my favourite song. It's do you know it? It's Gordon Lightfoot, If You Could Read My Mind. I said, yeah, I'll go and do it, because we'd had a few drinks. And the karaoke man sort of had to go to sort of page 1,000 of his karaoke book and dust it off. So, oh, yeah, here it is. So I got up on stage as if you could read my mind, and people stopped talking and looked around. And I walk away like a movie star who gets burned in the freeway. And they were leaving in a taxi, and within about, you know, but I didn't get to the first chorus, and the place was empty, apart from my mate who was crying. So that's lovely.
If only you could have read their minds, Rory, you might have realised that there wasn't a great interest for that song. I think it's quite interesting, though, those kind of songs that have an effect which is probably beyond the original intention of the song. I think there must be all sorts of pop songs which are, you know, released in sincerity and then actually go on to be something quite different.
Well, music's difficult. I like songs. I like songs a lot. And there are so many songs for me which is the best song ever. Ever. I just hear a song and say, that is the best song ever. And it changes sort of on an hourly basis, you know. Teenage Dirtbag by Wheatus was... for about a month, my favourite song of all time. I didn't think anything was going to shift it.
So that was released in about 2003.
Well done.
So I presumably could really relate to that at that stage in your career.
Well, people did refer to it as a middle-aged dirtbag, you know, even then. So I sort of did.
With the mind of a teenager.
Yeah, with the mind of a teenager, yeah. What do teenagers think about? Come on.
Well, I think we're back to the early parts of the interview.
Exactly, so, you know. We don't change that much, do we?
No, that's very true. So I wanted to talk a little bit as well, because you are quite famous for your bird watching. And it's something that interests me, because...
Now you're going to talk... I know what you're going to do now. You're going to talk about tits?
No, well...
Shag?
No, don't
chuff.
Worry. Unbelievable, Rory. I'm trying to have a serious, highbrow debate, he says, raising his eyebrows.
And you're going to mention the purple... headed ox pepper, ox pecker. There is a purple headed ox pecker.
No, oh, you brought the tits up. Well, your book was called Bearded Tit, wasn't
it? Was
it,
called Bearded Tit, yeah.
I thought it was
which
very...
is quite annoying, because the publisher said you should, because I was talking about bird watching before on some other program, and this publisher happened to be watching, and I said I wanted to do a bird watching program, which Bill Oddie sort of is the master and I'm the pupil, and he takes us round, takes me around teaching me about birds. And I said, and we call it Bearded Tits, you know. And this bloke heard it, said, why don't you write a book on your own? We'll call it Bearded Tit. And the joke was actually at Bill Oddie's expense, not my expense. So,
right. So If anyone's read that book and you're wondering that Rory
you
McGrath
mean
had
if anyone's read that, if anyone's
humor,
read that book.
No. It's an insult. Yeah. But do you view Bill Oddie as competition then? Is it once he sort of, you know, flies off to that big nest in the sky that you will assume your position on the perch of, you know, national treasure of the bird watching?
I'm trying to work out whether the, you know, description, the new Bill Oddie, is how much of a compliment. I do know him quite well. He doesn't know as many Latin names of birds as I do.
What an idiot. God, I know. Bill, call yourself a twitcher.
I know. Well, I go out bird watching more. I didn't sit in my room learning Latin lists of Latin names. I don't, yeah, I thought that's what bird watching was.
Yeah, I thought it was a close study of the genus.
And I saw him at some RSPB do, and I went up to him and said, "Bill, Panurus biomicus." He said, "Oh, fuck off."
Brilliant.
Great, yeah.
I don't think any podcast interview is complete without a Bill Oddie anecdote. In fact, if you have a chance to listen to the Alan Partridge autobiography, there's some brilliant little snippets in there where Bill Oddie features quite heavily, which I think, again, jokes at Bill's expense, but very funny.
I'm thoroughly enjoying this, and which is strange for me at 10:30 in the morning talking to a complete stranger.
You probably will have noticed, seeing as you are a keen ornithologist and birdwatcher and all the rest of it, that last month, I think, in Scotland, there was a very rare bird spotted. And you
Tall-tailed swift, wasn't it?
Yeah, the white-throated needle-tail.
Needle-tail, one of the fastest
Scotland.
Flying birds. And it hit a windmill.
Yeah, so basically, it was discovered in the UK only the ninth time since 1846. Everyone rushed up to Scotland to see it, and then it promptly flew into a wind turbine and died.
You're laughing. And when I read, this is very bad for my ornithological image, because I laughed when I read it. I hate wind farms, you know, but also I do hate this sort of fluffy sort of bunny hugging attitude about wildlife. You know, I mean, it's a shame. You know, birds, they have to, you know, they're going to keep flying into wind farms until until that gene that they make that sort of evolutionary shift. You know, it'll take about 4 billion. Needle-tailed swifts to hit before they think, hang on a minute, guys, we must stop flying into those huge propellers, you know. It will change.
Yeah,
it will change.
I mean, give them a few thousand years and they'll be avoiding them like nobody's business.
See, crows have worked out how to, you know, if a crow has a nut it can't crack, what it does is it drops it on a road until a car runs over and then goes and eats the inside of the nut.
That's really clever.
Now,
isn't
a lot
it?
Of crows got killed doing that. Yeah. So what they do, they drop it on pedestrian crossings, the cars go over it, then someone presses the button and the cars stop, it comes and gets the nut.
That's incredible.
It is. There's lots of footage of this. Crows are very clever.
Wow. Yeah. They are known to be one of the cleverer species as well, aren't they?
They are, yeah. I think this is intelligence. And intelligence is relative, is it not? Mm,
yeah, exactly. I mean, different animals have different levels and different measures of intelligence. Like some birds can count and some birds can recognise their own countenance as well. But then others, you know, other mammals can't do that. So
octopuses, they're very clever. They can play the banjo.
You've got one in your show, haven't you?
No, we haven't got a banjo, an octopus or a banjo.
Hey, like Larry, he's a
hell of a pianist. Yeah.
That'd be impressive, wouldn't it? 11 keys per tentacle.
That's right. Yeah, imagine how long a piano you could have with a the Rachmaninoff apparently
it was written for octopus.
Yeah, it was. Now, you see, the thing about... I know you've obviously done your research, but there was something on Wikipedia about me, two things which someone had looked at on Wikipedia, and the first question they asked me was based on this story which had got onto Wikipedia. It was, is it true that you once saw your accountant having sex with a mouse? And I couldn't, but...
And it was the mouse having sex with the accountant.
Comment I'd said, you know, about, you know, what traumatised me. And that's obviously the first thing that came into my head, you know. Rory McGrath was traumatised early in his life.
This octopus going to end up on Wikipedia now? Is that what's going to happen? Rory McGrath has a live octopus in his pants.
In his pants, yeah. and there was another thing. I said my first job was worm sexing in a silk factory. I've been asked that question so many times by interviews. They said, "So Rory, your first job out of before you went to university was worm sexing in a silk factory, wasn't it?" And I said, "Was it? Yeah,
yeah,
said, yeah." Apparently, because you know, it's very important for silk production that they can sex the worms. And you said that. I said it's very difficult to tell the difference between a male worm and a female worm. And the joke was something like, you know, female worms have more shoes and don't understand the offside trap. You know, something like that. It was some sort of lame joke like that. And, but obviously they'd taken this seriously. And of course you can't sex a worm because they don't have any sex, do they? Silkworm, yeah. So baloney.
Listen, it's been so lovely to speak to you and meet you. And thank
I really
you for
enjoyed it.
And,
I
and
now want to do it every day.
Yeah, excellent. Well, enjoy Edinburgh.
Thank
and,
you very much.
And yeah, we'll look forward to hopefully catching you at some point in the run. And when can people see the show?
What a very good question. tonight at 10 past 10 at Assembly 2.
Okay, and it runs throughout the festival?
We got 5 days off in the middle and it finishes on August the 27th.
Brilliant. Well, come on down, see Rory do lots of funny songs. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Ben.
Rory.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. It's the end of the show. It's still as hot as before, but I've got a feeling you'll be sticky for a different sort of reason now. After all, we've enjoyed the handsomely hirsute hilarity of Rory McGrath, one of the most lowbrow and funny guests we've ever met, the delightfully dulcet decibels of Brett Goldstein, one of the most dashing men in UK comedy, and me, who this week was mistaken for children's entertainer Gilbert Giggles. I had to Google Gilbert Giggles. I was gutted. We'll be back next week with more of what you expect from the Dave Weekly, so that's silly chatter and knob gags then. Meanwhile, why not explore our varied back catalogue on iTunes or tweet us at @join_Dave and me at @benchise. Till then, toodles doodles. The Dave Weekly is a Pixie production for Dave, hosted by me, Ben Shires, and produced by Joel Porter.
Would you give your mum, dad, aunt, or that uncle who hugged your partner a little too long free access to your phone?
Oh, no! Oh, my God, it's a really long video. Ew!
In Dave's brand new YouTube original, Get Off My Phone, we've got 6 comedians to give their phones over to a relative with total freedom to read messages, DMs, photos, and browser history.
Where's your search history?
Sorry?
What to do, tips for relief.
The rules are simple. Their relative can read anything they want and even make calls from the comedian's phone.
What is this? What is...
I don't want this one.
That looks really bad.
Starring Tanya Moore, Anya Magliano, Finlay Christie, Travis J with his mum Angie Lamar, Hayley Morris, Grace Campbell and dad Alistair Campbell.
Slightly sexually compromising people.
Divulging their deepest digital secrets.
What the hell is happening?
Get Off My Phone, a Dave YouTube original. Available now on Dave's YouTube channel.